Hi, you are listening to a free Majority Report. If you would like to become a member, please go to majority.fm.
Yes,
oh, my name's Janine Garofalo. How are you?
It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, January 25th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It is Friday. You know what that means. Cliff Schechter will be joining us to look back on the week that was. Also on the program today, making his first return visit to the Majority Report in 2013, Matthew Film Guy. Yes, that guy, Matthew Film Guy. Folks, I cannot tell a lie. I'm not here right now. I'm in a different location. Bring that music down a little bit. Let's make this a little more intimate. I pre-taped the show. Now, for literally thousands upon thousands of you, every show is pre-taped. But for those thousands of you who listen to it live, you're not listening to me now because I'm pre-taping this. So I had this conversation with Cliff yesterday, although as I'm saying it, it's today. Nevertheless, still timely, still important, and I know you'll enjoy it. So let's take a quick break, and let me remind you that we count on your support to do this show every day. And by we, I mean me and those other two guys, Matt and Michael, and other people who work freelance. It is your support, your membership, which gives us the revenue to do this show. You can become a member at majority.fm/become a member, just or head over there and just click on the top of the page. You'll see the link. Other ways of supporting the show, I've said in the past, but being a member is the one that really obviously helps us out. Now, of course, if you can't afford it, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. You want access to the extra 50 minutes a day. Yesterday on the program, I spoke to a guy who really, really liked Reaganism. And it was rather amusing. But if you really want access to that second half of the show and you cannot afford it, send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll work something out. If you can't afford it, please, by all means, become a member. Whether it's to get that extra content or not, you'll help support the existence of even the first half of the show. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Cliff Schechter.
It's a sunny day, but you still have
Hello, Majority Report listener. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. I don't know what's funny about that. The internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. I always promote nonfiction books, but they got fiction books too. But you can get a free one right now at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Why not pick up The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Win by Jeff Connaughton. He is featured in that film that we talked about with Elliot Spitzer yesterday on the program. You can go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report and pick up a free version of the audiobook of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report. And now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, we have, of course, Cliff Schechter. But before we get to Cliff Schechter, he needs to be properly introduced by his specifically branded theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.com.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It is time now, as it is the end of the week, for Cliff Schechter to look back upon the week and make it all make sense for us. Hello, Cliff. How are you?
I am doing great. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm doing quite well, Cliff, as well as can be expected. I am now, as you know, almost 8 months pregnant. And
how's your belly feeling?
My belly is actually feeling great, but the rest of me is taking a beating.
Yeah, that's probably 'cause you had a steak before the show, I'm sure.
Indeed. But all right, so, Cliff, this is what I'm thinking this week. There's a lot of stories that sort of tie into, sort of oddly enough, the future politics. I mean, we had the sort of failure, I think, and we're recording this on Thursday, of course, but it really appears that in the Senate, anyways, filibuster reform is basically been watered down to the point of being virtually zero reform. I mean, would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I think that's worth discussing in the context of what we're going to discuss today, because I'm not going to try to go off on too much of a rant. But I mean, these are those types of days when you see these guys act this way. And, you know, I literally sometimes feel like giving up, because the Republicans can do stuff like they wait till people are out of town to make changes and go and do whatever it takes. And we can have 55 people in the Senate, and they won't even do the simplest of things. It's either amazing. It makes you wonder if they're all bought off, or they're all the biggest wimps in the world, or a combination of both.
I think there's a third answer. I mean, you know, there's been multiple sets of reforms that have been on the table, and it seems like one is getting more watered down after the other. One of the reforms was the talking filibuster, which would make it not so offhanded, which would weaken the filibuster. We talked about it earlier this week with Brian.
It would be
Boyle.
Crazy to make people actually have to get up and defend their ideas, yeah, and they're blocking legislation, right?
Yeah, and it would require a level of commitment from 41 senators that heretofore they don't have to exhibit. They can just sort of say, like, yeah, whatever, I will, I'll join you in this. If they've really got no skin in the game. Then another reform was that you actually have to have 41 senators vote for a filibuster, as opposed to rack up 60 votes to break a filibuster. And that distinction, for some people, it may sound like a difference without a distinction. But again, it comes to that you need a higher level of enthusiasm for the filibuster if you're required to deliver the votes.
Well, these guys would all have to stay on the floor, too.
Right.
At any time, if they didn't have their 41 votes, you could just say, okay, now we're going to vote on it. So it would require they're actually having some commitment to being there.
Right. And so it would basically just raise the stakes. Now, what has come out now is just basically, we don't know the details, but it doesn't include those two reforms. To me, the reason why we see this is not just because is a combination of two things. One, it is senators on the Democratic side. I mean, obviously, the Republicans have a very sort of blatant reason to be against this because it disempowers them in some respects. But it also disempowers individual senators. In other words, it means that individual senators lose some of their power if they were in the minority and whatnot. I mean, we can hear all this stuff about the protecting the institution and blah, blah, blah. And I don't think it's that they're wimpy about it. I think it's that they want to protect what they have. And it is a lack of, to the extent that there's any wimpiness here, there's a lack of leverage and a lack of willing of Democrats basically willing to say, we're going to punish you insofar as fundraising or whatnot if you don't go along with us. That's right. Where the wimpiness is.
You're right. You know, I mean, that may be it, and they're preserving their power. But it's amazing how they're preserving their power by throwing overboard their ability to create any kind of legacy for themselves or get anything done they actually care about. So I suppose it makes it clear that that's the only thing that's important to them. I mean, now is, you know, this assault weapons ban being proposed by Senator Dianne Feinstein, which I applaud her on that particular measure. But she's one of the ones who apparently refuses to do anything about the filibuster, who is blocked in doing anything meaningful. So she basically has just made sure that the legislation she's put out there will not make it through. Because it's quite likely you can get a 50-something majority in that Senate on an assault weapons ban. Getting past 60 is going to be a lot tougher. And so that tells me what Dianne Feinstein's priorities are, and it makes me sick, frankly. You know, I just am so tired of this, and we're all tired of this. And I just wish there were a way that we could throw all of these people out and get new Democrats. Not all, I shouldn't say all. There's some great people like Jeff Merkley and others that were fighting for this thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, what do they ever get tired of being losers? You know, do they ever get tired of walking around watching Republicans when they're out of town, like they just did in Virginia, which we're going to talk about, basically steal the chamber away from them? If the Republicans do what they're planning on doing in all these states, which we're going to talk about, Ohio and Virginia and whatever, which is diluting the Electoral College impact so that Democrats can't win presidential elections, they're giving up power too. The Republicans are, because their states are going to be much less important. If you can't win a block of votes in Ohio or Florida, but why is it Republicans to do things that are blatantly, you know, go against at least the expectations of the way this country was founded? Why are they always willing to do that, but the Democrats aren't willing to do what is right there in front of them? It just gets so tiring.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question
of one arm tied behind your back.
Part of it is a function, in some instances, of party discipline, and I think part of it is that you know, I was talking to Boyler about this too. Is that I think, you know, the fact of the matter is that to have the filibuster means that you can vote for something even if you know it's not going to pass. That you can take a vote that will appeal to your base, but may not offend people outside your base because it never comes to actually happening.
Yep.
And, you know.
You're right. I mean, there's all sorts of – you're right. There's other reasons to do it. All of them have to do with protecting your pathetic, selfish ass over doing something – actually getting something done in there. This embarrassing body that the entire world laughs at. You know, that's what our Senate is. It's a laughingstock for the fact that nothing ever happens there. And on top of that, you know, it's easily, you know, from things I've read and whatever, the body that gives any real Democratic legislative chamber in the world, the one that gives the minority party in there the most power to block anything from happening. I mean, it's an embarrassment, and they should be embarrassed. They're pathetic. They will look at what their approval rating is. You know, and that the Democrats don't seem to care. They care more about their little turf than they do about the fact that they're an embarrassing joke and that they're losers, that they walk around and they lose all the time. When they're in the majority, even when they've got everything on their side, they find a way to lose. When Republicans find a way to win, when they've got everything against them, it's pathetic.
We'll have a better idea in the coming days as to which of those Democratic senators were against this. But I mean, you can more or less guess, although I've also heard that there may be one or two surprises. I'm not quite sure yet. But I mean, it's quite clear that Harry Reid didn't have the votes. If he had had the votes, I think he would have done it. I think he would have taken it to the floor, but it's quite clear he didn't even have the 51 votes on the Democratic side to do this, which is, you know, like you say, it's pathetic. But let's
move. That raises questions again, you know, about his leadership, which I don't know. We don't have time to get completely into. But I mean, if we're going to make fun of John Boehner when he can't get his caucus together on stuff, you know, Harry Reid deserves the same treatment.
And he's had a year. I mean, it was in 2000. It was a year ago where he said, "Hey, we made a mistake. We're not going to make that mistake again." So it's not like he hasn't had time to deal with this, and it's not the freshmen. It's not the freshman senators who are the issue here.
That's what I mean. It's like there's a point where it becomes where it's like, do you get embarrassed by anything? Do you have any shame?
Right.
I guess not. I guess the power, the money, all that stuff is more important than your personal pride or having any shame. But when you say something like that, like we learned, you know, as if they ever did, they need to learn. Really? You need to learn that Mitch McConnell was going to block stuff?
Right.
Wow. I'm glad that you were able – so that they learned, but then they just he just obviously didn't learn because he repeated the same thing again. You know what I mean? Oh, well, we know, like, we're not going to vote anything without a public option. Oh, yep, yes, we are. I mean, does anybody take you seriously anymore at that point?
I don't know. No. I mean, I think it obviously diminishes their credibility, but at the end of the day, I think you're right. It's just sort of they look in the mirror and they say, I'm the Senate leader. I'm a senator. And everything else is gravy after that.
I guess so. You know, I guess that's the point it's gotten to.
All right. Let's talk just briefly about what also took place in the Senate and the House this week, only because, again, this leads into the sort of future elections. Hillary Clinton was in front of Senate hearings on Benghazi and House hearings on Benghazi. I mean, the whole thing, it's just it's certainly appropriate for there to be hearings on this, I guess. But the way that these have been politicized is sort of pathetic. And it, to my mind, this is about 2016, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course it is. I mean, look, when Rand Paul sat there, the gall of this guy who's been there for 2 years, you know, who has literally no principles, who hates all government but accepts all sorts of Medicare payments for his practice and talks about how doctors need to make a living too. I mean, forcing somebody to allow African-Americans to have lunch at the lunch counter is too much government intrusion. But, you know, the fact that doctors need to make a nice living too is enough to accept Medicare payments. I mean, he's perhaps one of the biggest hypocrites in there. I think somebody said he's basically a jerk, or I won't use the word they used, so that you don't have to edit more for this to go on radio, who believes the same thing as his dad without his dad's crazy old uncle charm. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's kind of what Rand Paul – so Rand Paul wants to run for president in 2016, so he sat there challenging Hillary Clinton. And again, you know, I don't know if that raccoon in his head he calls hair is messes with his thinking to the point where he can't put numbers together, but he spent the whole time talking about how this is the worst tragedy, you know, the first worst national security tragedy since 9/11. First of
all, not. To be fair, he said the original 9/11.
Oh, the original 9/11?
That's the way he answered. That's what he, that's the other way that he opened up his speech. Like, this is the, this is like, I'm not talking about the original 9/11. I mean, that's, he's
like trying to turn this into 9/11, by the way, the one that his party never really did anything to get to the bottom of, blocked every real inquiry. And now we know from books that have come out and whatever that Condi Rice, who of course is just added to CBS News as a contributor to bring all her brilliant knowledge on how to start wars based on faulty evidence and how to ignore warnings. Well, I guess we'll get to learn all of that. Ignore, you know, she and the people around her only ignored about 4,000 warnings of what was going to happen, which led to 3,000 Americans dying. And then lied their way into a war in Iraq based upon it that's led to thousands more dying. But that's comparable to 4 people dying in a war zone in Libya. You know, this is the worst thing since then, but obviously they're very comparable in scope. And that's not to say that what happened isn't a terrible thing. It's not to say what happened with Ambassador Stevens.
Right.
Unlike them, I do believe in getting to the bottom of things and do believe there should be a Rand Paul, Daryl Issa type inquiry where people actually try to get to the bottom of it somewhere so American diplomats aren't killed in places where there should be more security. But that's not what they're doing here.
Right.
This is Rand Paul running for president, and then Ron Johnson, crazy, you know, kook, like all these governors we were saddled with in 2010 that don't really represent their swing states. We've got this guy from, you know, senator from the Koch brothers in Wisconsin who doesn't represent the swing state of Wisconsin one bit, and what of a lunatic he is. And what was fun was watching him take on Hillary Clinton, watching her literally just swat him away like a fly and knock him back.
What was interesting is that Kerry, during his confirmation hearing, which took place on Thursday, basically singled out Johnson for missing briefings, classified briefings on Benghazi. You know, I think McCain also did the same, at least in terms of early hearings. And so there definitely seems like, and this I want to, this will lead us nicely into the inauguration, and then and we can talk about the sort of what the Republicans are doing about this. But
right,
the inaugural speech, it's just a speech. Kerry calling out Ron Johnson is just, you know, rhetoric and whatnot. But there definitely is a different rhetorical stance that the administration is taking, and I think it's gonna, we're gonna see it filter down to lawmakers as well. Whether this is going to end up being meaningful in any respect whatsoever when it comes to legislation, I have my sincere doubts. But but for the moment, let's just look at this, because you know, you and I think are both people who are very much interested in policy, but we're not the type of people who believe that this is distinct from politics and from optics, and that today's optics end up leading to tomorrow's policies. We've seen this time and time again. We're still feeling the implications of President Obama getting up there and saying a family, you know, family needs to tighten its belt, so shouldn't government.
No, you're right. The bully pulpit, what you say, is hugely important. And the fact that, that he made that counterproductive argument has haunted us and allowed the debt scolds to get a rhetorical advantage, an advantage in what people think needs to be done in general over you know, people that actually understand how economics works and care about people having jobs, for example. So you're right. And what he said, you know, look, there was a hugely, in my estimation, I think many other people that I've read, a very progressive speech that Obama gave, and he made this sort of full-throated defense of many things that you and I had wished he had done in the past, essentially of government's role in our society, especially, obviously, as many people said, on the gay rights front. Throwing in Stonewall with Selma and Seneca Falls was a huge, huge thing. Mentioning climate change, doing things like that. You know, and so I think you hope it does set a tone, although, again, it's sort of like that was a great moment, and then you deal, you watch them, you know, peter away in the filibuster reform day, and you wonder to yourself, you know, have they already ensured that that moment's
right.
over? I don't know. You know, I hope not. But I would have thought that if he was sort of a field general giving orders there to his party, they would have gotten with it today. You know, on things. So I hope, you know, I mean, he obviously had a very bold and I would say all around fantastic plan on to reform our gun laws. He talked about immigration and about climate change, which are two hugely important issues. And so I'm hoping, you know, I really am. But
I think, I mean, we've had this talk before, but you know, he. President Obama famously said that he admired Ronald Reagan for essentially changing the discourse in this country. You know, policy aside, he admired the ability that he had on our culture. Now, you and I, same generation. You're significantly older than I am, however. But
much better, much less good looking too.
Well, you know, it's something. I'm aging nicely, but no. But the reality is, we both, or at least I did. You know, I missed voting for the first time by just a number of weeks, and I was hoping to vote against Ronald Reagan that first time, or I guess the second time he ran in '84. I think I turned.
You're way older than me.
I know.
I couldn't even vote for Dukakis.
And so I. You know, I went through that whole thing where, you know, Alex P. Keaton in the sweater vest. Now, I adopted maybe some of the look, but not so much the politics. And, you know, where I went to school in the Northeast, there was a lot of guys going around in the chinos blazer look of P.J. O'Rourke. I mean, this is this is dystopian times. You know, the implications of Ronald Reagan. In fact, yesterday I was on the phone in the better half of the program talking to a guy who just kept going on and on about Reaganism. And the point is, nothing he was saying was even related to what Reagan did, or to the extent that it was divorced from its implications. But there's this force And to a certain extent,
well, myth is important, and rhetoric
I think
is important.
Obama, for all his faults, one of the things that we anticipated that he would do, regardless of what he got done legislatively, was to make the argument to all of those 18 to 24-year-olds, those 18 to 30-year-olds who got excited about voting for him, to provide for them some type of ideological framework in which to view our society as, you know, from a liberal's framework. And frankly, I think that we heard that for the first time during his inauguration, for what it's worth. But I do think it's worth something, maybe not in the next 5 or 10 years, but in 20 years.
No, I think it's enormously important. I just am hoping. Well, I mean, I'm used to criticizing him and pointing, you know, at times saying he makes these speeches and doesn't follow up. He made sort of the Teddy Kennedy-esque speech out in Kansas, you know, and economics, very economically populist, whenever it was a year or 2 years ago, and then didn't really follow up on it. But I will say, you know, in this case, in terms of following up on it, he actually already had done something very bold on guns and went beyond where many of us thought he would go to take risks that we didn't think he would take. So in a way, some of the proof is there already that he's changed at least some of his view of things and is not willing to just say, I'm only going to take on battles I know I can win.
Right.
I'm actually going to fight for things that need to be done and change the trajectory of politics and the way people think about our politics.
I'm still convinced that he only takes on battles. I'm still convinced that he only takes on battles that he's pretty convinced he can win. It's just that at least now he's not ignoring those. I mean, I don't think that we're going to see anything on the economic front, but I think, frankly, you know, he came out strong with gun proposals, and it was, you know, in the wake of a horrible tragedy that, of course, you know, I don't care what you think about guns, the idea that society is not going to act after 20 kids are murdered by an automatic weapon is just – it's fanciful.
I mean, and truth be told, some of the stuff he did is a little more – I wouldn't call it controversial. It's just a little bit more mixed as in, oh, no, we only have a 60 to 70% majority.
Right. Well, right.
When it comes to background checks, like, you know, background checks are almost more popular than porn.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I mean,
I don't know what you can find that 100% of society agrees upon. But background checks, the last two polls that have been done have polled north of 90%. One had them at 96 and the other had them at 91. And the questions were asked slightly different ways, which may have made that difference. But the point being that if you can't stand up for something that over 9 in 10 people, including like something like 77% of Republicans and 87% of gun owners stand up for, I know what you're saying, although some of the assault weapon stuff is more mixed, even though, again, it does have 60 or 65% plus.
Right. I mean, I think he sees that something may be at a tipping point, and he will press and push that over the scales. Now, of course, we're not going to see that necessarily with Social Security, because with Social Security, we have 80% basically say don't touch it. And I think we still may see that touched. But
we still may see change CPI or something. No, I agree with you. I think that he sees his legacy as taking sort of a small cut out of whatever it is to say that he reformed it.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's obviously a notion we need to disabuse him of, and we've already done somewhat and have to keep doing. But, you know, no, I agree. I just think, you know, here and there, I'm not saying he's taking far-reaching, you know, strides and doing things that are so far. You're right. He's not moving us in the same directions, you know, vastly different direction Reagan did at a similar moment when all the forces are adding up to a point where Reagan had everything kind of going for him to do that and the communication skills to do that. But it still was an important speech. It still moved us in a largely different direction. The gun stuff still, some of those proposals are relatively bold. And we just need to see what he does about the rest of things, because, look, climate change is something that can't wait.
Yeah,
It's enormously important. Let's see what he does, because obviously a hugely controversial one.
I think he's just waiting for senators to line up. We've already got like 5 or 6 Democratic senators who are already coming out supporting this Keystone XL pipeline. You know, we don't know exactly who they are, but we know that they're on some type of list or have sent a letter. We'll find out shortly, I'm sure. But my point, you know, getting back to the rhetoric for a second, because I think this is what, you know, the inaugural speech is really more about. It's about those optics. Jonathan Chait had a piece this week pointing out that Pew poll shows this statistic, which I think, you know, we've talked about, but it really puts it in stark relief. among the 2012 electorate, 35% of people ID'd themselves as conservative, 25% as liberal. 51% said the government is already doing too much that should be left to the private sector. Okay. However, yep. However, with voters under 30, 59% to 37% say government should do more to solve problems. 33% of voters under 30 identify themselves as liberal versus 26% who call them conservative. This is the direction things are moving into. Moving.
Yeah,
and a big chunk of that has to be attributable at least to the idea of Obama, and at least in terms of an idea, you know, because most people do not pay attention to actual policy or to what happens with our government. Certainly not like you and I do, but even, you know, the people who are listening to our voices right now don't pay attention to that. But the general public, they just sign on to a couple of markers and they just sign on to a couple of ideas. Reaganism, you know, freedom, liberty. Well, in this instance, you know, you've got a president going up there and saying the word collectivism as a positive thing.
And you and I have been yelling, you know, and about this, which is this is what we sort of expected from his first term and wanted more of. And so, you know, we have to give credit where it's due. And I think it is enormously important. And it's not just Obama. It's the idea of what he's saying, but it's also looking at, as we've all already gone through, also who was elected this time. You know, again, that kook we were talking about earlier who doesn't represent his state, you know, Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, that same state just, you know, elected an open lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't, you know, that wasn't Massachusetts that did that or New York. It was Wisconsin. You know what I mean? Sherrod Brown got a resounding reelection from Ohio. So did Bill Nelson in Florida. You had obviously all of the gay marriage, proposals or legislation. I'm sorry, what am I looking for? Referenda passed, and all of the two ones dealing with legalizing pot. I mean, there's no doubt that this coalition, again, under 30, that under 30, under 40, even, you know, it hugely in a progressive direction. But then when you combine it with the rest of the coalition, which is, you know, single women, well-educated whites, yeah, African-Americans, Asians, Hispanics, it becomes a dominant, with the exception of maybe about 10 or 15 states in this country.
And contrary to what people say, you don't get more conservative as you get older. You basically, your party and sort of ideological affiliation is extremely sticky, as they say.
Yeah, you tend to remain that way.
Right.
Or, you know, I mean, there's no doubt about that. You tend to remain in the same basic ballpark of where you were politically before, and party-wise, very much so. And so, you know, even states that conservatives considered, you know, once considered their anchors, like Virginia and North Carolina, and do even at this moment, like Georgia and Texas, that are rapidly changing, Arizona, you know, are changing underneath their feet due to the new coalition that we're talking about here. So what Jonathan Chait wrote about is what we've been talking about is very important. I just think in light of some of the other things we've been talking about, it's important people understand that still this stuff doesn't just solve itself.
Right.
Because right-wingers, conservatives, privileged people that don't want their power and their money taken away, find ways to thwart the majority.
Well, that's
you know,
a perfect lead-in.
They pass citizens united in the courts so that people can outspend you. You know, they suppress votes so that you can't they suppress votes of many groups so you don't get the, you know, they were polls, I guess, what was it, somebody did a study that the Democrats lost 11,000 votes in Florida due to all the lines.
Right.
That were, you know, and that didn't matter in the end, but it could have mattered. And now, of course, I'll let you do the segue.
I mean, I've talked about this story a couple of times this week and in one shape or another. The latest update is coming out of Virginia. Now, I'm not talking about the story about Virginia doing their redistricting when a civil rights leader who was one of the senators in the state Senate, 2020 Senate in Virginia, one of them goes to the inauguration. He's a civil rights leader, and they sneak through a redistricting to change from 2011 to shore up more Republican districts for the state legislators. We're now seeing that same mechanism starting to be put into effect. I mean, in Pennsylvania, Ohio, we've talked about this. You have the Democratic top of the ticket taking the state by, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 percentage points, but losing the congressional delegation by 2-1. And that's consistent with the million extra votes that Democrats got across the country in terms of congressional candidates, but still did not win the majority of congressional seats. What we're seeing is essentially this redistricting, which has strengthened the Republican hold on the House, on these congressional districts. But now they want to parlay that into electoral victories for presidents because they want to apportion their electoral votes based upon congressional districts. So you've probably seen the data as much as I have, so that a state like Ohio, for instance, or Pennsylvania would end up, or Michigan, instead of getting the complete, whatever it is, 18, 15, 12 electoral votes, it would be split. And in this same election, Mitt Romney would have won.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that imagine, first, it's terrible on a couple of levels. First of all, again, like with Citizens United and voter suppression efforts, which clearly suppressed a certain number of votes, just not enough for them, although it may have been enough for them to steal a couple state House seats, we don't know, and things like that. They're using this mechanism now to corrupt all levels of government from their elections, their victories in 2010. They've corrupted the state legislatures by redistricting those in an unbelievably partisan and disgusting way. Then they've used that because the state legislatures play a big role often in choosing how the congressional districts are set up and redistricting those in a way that, as you pointed out, I think Democrats did won somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million more votes for House members and still picked up 8 seats and they're still down, 17 at this point? But now that's not even enough. Now they're going to go and they're going to corrupt the presidential election too. Mind you, this is all about electoral reform. You don't see them doing this in Texas. You don't see them doing this in states that they're going to win. What they're doing right now in states that are swing states that Obama won but are right now controlled by right-wing legislatures or ones that are moving in Obama's direction that he either won before or he almost won. I'm thinking of North Carolina. They're talking about doing this now in North Carolina, Virginia, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Florida, and I'm probably missing one or two others. And I mean, you know, this would mean that President Obama could have won by – where did he win by now? Where are we? 3-4 million votes?
Right.
He won by in the end,
yep.
And still could lose.
Yep.
I mean, it not only is it sickening in a way that the right is literally stealing power, like that could cause a massive constitutional crisis in this country.
I think so. It's one thing to say 500,000 votes. Well, what we need to do is just get rid of the electoral system by going to a national popular vote, which
that's the answer, yes.
Which we're getting there.
But if people want to know why I'm, one of the reasons I was so pissed off today and obviously angry about the Democrats backing off the filibusters here, you've got 55 guys there in the Senate, 55 guys and gals, I should say, 55 Democrats who can't even get this reformed filibuster. But in Virginia, right across the water there, you know, a famed civil rights leader who's a state senator, as you pointed out, goes to inauguration of the first black president on Martin Luther King Day, and they use Jim Crow tactics to steal his seat away. And that's what gets me so just unbelievably angry. Look at what they're willing to do compared to what our side is willing to do.
Right.
And it just is unbelievably frustrating. I mean, we're going to need a huge effort to stop them from doing this in all these states, because they have looked at the same demographics as Jonathan Chait and plenty of other people and determined that if they keep their current policies, they can't win. But they can't change their policies or their base won't turn out for them. So they're stuck. But if they can find a way to get around that by corrupting the presidential vote, by corrupting the congressional votes, you know, by making sure there's a filibuster in place, so senators from a bunch of aligned states that all, you know, that all have the South Dakota, Montana, Utah, that all have the smallest, smallest populations that are mostly rural, can thwart the will of the majority, then they can still maintain some control, a lot of control.
And they're doing this in conjunction with, they're going to be able to do this simply by numbers. And the upside is, of course, they're still going to be able to talk about rape as much as they want to.
Yes, and that is an upside because they seem to be addicted to talking about that. As the good New Mexico State Representative Catherine Brown.
Yeah, let's leave on this note because this is just stunning. But this note is This is pretty impressive. Now, Cliff, you know this is coming on the heels of their trust retreat that they had with other Republicans,
the
right?
Down at the plantation?
Right, yes, at a former slave plantation. They were basically told, please stop talking about rape. Please, it's just there's
the
no
God.
Upside to you talking about rape. And then literally
talk about something better, like scurvy.
A day later, now apparently this Republican lawmaker did not get the word. And to be fair, this is not a member of Congress. It's a
she's only a state rep, and she's
only
a
state rep.
Alec may not have kicked in the money for her to go to this thing.
That's right. She may not have been invited to the plantation for the soul searching, but
as we talked about last time, for the channeling of Jefferson Davis's ghost for some policy ideas.
There you go.
For how the Republican Party, which they seem to be channeling very well in Virginia, I might say.
Now her name is Catherine Brown. Is that it?
Her name is Catherine Brown. She introduced a bill. She's a New Mexico state representative.
House Bill 206.
It would legally require victims of rape to carry their pregnancies to term, get this, in order to use the fetus as evidence for a sexual assault trial. So I guess you need the fetus to prove you were assaulted somehow. I'm not really sure how that works. I am not a doctor, although apparently neither are Republicans.
If you cannot have an abortion because you would be tampering with evidence,
that's right,
of from your being raped. I mean, this is now the bill is not going to pass, right? Because Democrats have a majority in both houses of
basically this makes the transvaginal ultrasound look like something the ACLU would propose.
But how demented are these people? I mean, these people are just warped.
Well, but you know what this – you've spoken to a friend of mine, I think, on your show and as well as part of Ring of Fire, Tracy Wheats, who's an activist on abortion rights.
Yes, this week.
And as she often talks about and others in the abortion rights movement that it's not about – when they try to make it like it's about children and they're – and they say, oh, it's murder. It's about women's sexuality. It always is. It's about their ickiness, their fear of women's sexuality, because if it wasn't, you wouldn't be having this – they wouldn't be able to constantly stuck on rape. They wouldn't constantly be, stuck on birth control. They're always on these issues because it just seems like they can't get this out of their heads. They just are, just the way gays just is something that they're all freaked out by, these old white guys who are still threatened by that. They're also threatened by women's sexuality.
I think,
and again, this may be a woman, but whatever. She's not
right.
Wonder
she buys
mindset.
Into the same patriarchal notion. She yes. has, that she's been told by her husband, whatever it is. The other point that Tracy Wheats
don't look at me until the sheet is fully removed.
Right,
and I'm out of the room.
The other point that Tracy Wheats makes is that, for a lot of times for these conservatives, they have no other legislation that they can bring up that will be functional in any way. And so this is a way of basically placating their base. I mean, this woman knows that this bill is never going to pass. But, the value of talking about it is, in fact, this is where the stuff that we see, like the transvaginal probes, this is where the personhood amendments 6 years ago. We were talking about this stuff in the same way. This is a freak show. This is marginal. It can never happen. And then we start to see that it actually does.
Same thing with Social Security. Yep. Same thing with many other things. I mean, this is kind of like what we said is the value of having President Obama and others stand up and speak out on issues is because by speaking about them, you make them possible, even if the first time people dismiss them. Well, sadly, it works that way on the crazy right, too, and they've been doing it for 30 years now because, again – Ronald Reagan, their saint, had he run in this past election, would have seemed a lot like John Huntsman or perhaps a little bit to the left of him.
Yes.
The guy that was unacceptable to them because he was too much of a moderate. That's what you would have been looking at. I think actually he would have been thinking about policy-wise, he would have been somewhat more moderate than John Huntsman. And, that's how they push this agenda. So, yeah, you're right. This woman people laugh at and you and I mock her because we need to because she's crazy. But at the same time, she's brought this up. And I promise you for the next year or two, some other obscure state legislator somewhere, maybe not, maybe a Louis Gohmert type, cartoon character in Congress will do it. But that's how the birther stuff started, too, and other things like that.
Yep. You're absolutely right. I would guarantee it. I would actually put my firstborn on the table. I mean, my secondborn.
There
on
you
the
go.
Table.
Put your second board on the table.
My newly born, new, soon to be born. I
would
bet.
You get more sleep that way, and that's important.
I would bet. All right. Well, Cliff Schechter, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always my pleasure, Sam. Thanks for having me on, buddy.
Until next week, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about then as well.
Somehow we always do.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, man.
Bye. All right, folks, now it is time to talk to Matthew Film Guy. As you know, last week we spoke to Isabel Gillies, the week before Chris Rosen. It is now time for Matthew Film Guy. I guess the week before that was David Cross. We sort of really saved the best for last in the rotation, so to speak. Not necessarily the case. But before we have Matthew Film Guy on... First, let us play the Matthew Film Guy bumper by the artist The Talls. Oh, I guess I'll play.
I got it. Jeez.
Matthew the Film Guy is choosing your streams. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such themes.
There you go, Matthew Film Guy. That's right, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello, Sam.
Hello, Matthew. I got an email, or I think we got a review on iTunes a while back that said, I don't like all the heavy metal music you play on that show. And we only play, there's only two heavy metal songs I think we've ever played on this program. One is by the official Majority Report metal band. That would be Muckraker. We Are the Majority is the song. And the other one is the Matthew Film Guy bumper, which is yours. So thank you for basically costing us at least one listener, Matthew.
I'm sorry about that, Sam. I hope I can make up for it with a good movie review or recommendation. But I think, actually, Sam, let me take this opportunity to say, I think you're a little too sensitive about some of the comments being made on your reviews.
Really?
I don't think, first of all, the sound quality is generally great. And I know that put you into a little bit of a spin when you heard that the sound quality was the reason why somebody was not listening.
No.
I don't think that's relevant.
I wasn't sensitive to the fact that they think the sound quality is bad. I mean, I think the sound quality is good. More than anybody my production quality credo. What I really dislike, and you know this as well as anybody, is someone saying I love your content, but I'm an audiophile, and so I don't like to listen to spoken word if it's at the wrong frequency. What's that?
But can't you just dismiss those kinds of silly comments? I mean, heavy metal. Come on, if that's really what your grain of sand is in this whole thing, is then I don't think that these people are really your audience.
Well, I mean, yeah, I agree, but I still find that
basically what I'm saying is it's not my fault. It's not my fault.
I'm not blaming you. Now, people are probably wondering why you know my production credo, because you have worked with me on multiple productions as either as an actor I've hired you, as an assistant.
That's right.
As an
assistant actor.
As an assistant actor. And you've
done
been
camera
you've
work
acted,
for you. I've
camera
been editing
work,
for
editing.
You, sure, yeah.
Yes. All of it. You edited my wedding video.
That's right. That's really still the highlight of my career.
Yeah, and we know where that led.
Yeah, exactly. Nowhere.
Well, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the imminent birth of my second child.
Oh, right. Yeah, I feel like my video had something to do with that, definitely.
Maybe. Maybe we should have watched it before we did that. We did that again to get another.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking also about some baby names for you, Sam.
Well,
you know,
we'll get to that in a second.
Joining in.
I know.
Okay.
Apparently, my wife, Nikki, ran into Isabel on the street the other day. And now Isabel is pushing the name Zebediah or something.
Zebediah. Wow.
Yeah.
Is that sort of a hillbilly name?
No, apparently
like
it's some type of like
name?
Ancient Hebrew name.
Very,
I got news for you, folks. Isabel Gillies, not Jewish.
No, I know. I could tell from both names.
Right. Now, okay. So but let's put that aside for a moment. And I want to catch people up here. You suggested in the great 2012, end of the year 2012, film recommender from Majority Report Face Off that was held between you and Isabel. Isabel recommended, what was that film? Win-Win. You recommended The Kid with the Bike, right? With some type of, or in French, Le Gamin en Vélo.
Very good.
Is my understanding. And
that sounds good to me.
I told Isabel that I watched her film, but I'm not going to discuss it with her because I wanted you on simultaneously to announce the winner. And then I realized technically what we should have done is done this last week. But.
Yeah, I was sort of thinking that.
Yeah, but I didn't. I to be honest with you, I hadn't watched your film yet, The Kid with the Bike.
That's all right.
And I watched hers last
minute. I heard Isabel's segment last week, so she took a couple shots at me. I want to respond.
Well, okay, that's fine. As of last week, I had not watched your film, and I'll be honest with you because I don't want to lie to you, Matthew. I haven't watched your film yet either today.
No, I understand. I understand. I hardly expect you to watch the films I recommend at this point. You know,
no,
this is just for
I'm going to watch it.
Fodder for discussion, and you know,
I'm going to watch it. What I wanted to ask you, and I should have recommended this to you earlier in the week, is to watch Dogtooth, because I'm curious about what you think about that film.
Yeah, I actually did download it, so I have it in the queue. So,
download it.
I'm
what
going
do you mean,
to get
download
to watch
it.
That.
You mean
you know,
Netflix?
I saved it to my computer.
How did you do that with Netflix?
I'll tell you off air.
Okay. Interesting. Well, all right. So I think you should watch that for the next time that you come on because interesting film. Interesting film. And then we can talk about it. And then, you know, so now I've recommended a film to you. One of our listeners has been insisting I watch Dogtooth.
I recall.
Yeah. All right. So The Kid with a Bike, we're not going to discuss it. I'm going to watch it.
Now Isabel said that it's one of these movies that you may fall asleep during, but I want to just speak to that. It's not an action film, but it is a gripping drama. So if you're able to watch it when you have a moment that you're not distracted, I think that's going to be your best bet. But it is not a slam bam action laugh a minute kind of
just to fuel the
fire. It does require a little bit of concentration, a little bit of effort to pay attention, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think just like, you know, you want people not to consume politics like candy, you don't want to just consume films like candy either. Sometimes it's good, but a couple of films that are, you know, nurturing your soul and requiring a little bit more of your intellect or at least your attention span, I think is a good thing for everybody.
Wow, this segment has really turned into like the eat your kale, segment.
But kale can be delicious. This isn't.
I'm talking about the Russian kale.
Yeah, it's not with a lot of dressing.
The Russian, the purple kale, not the green kale, which can be much sweeter. All right.
Well, I'm just talking about having a deeper appreciation for art and life, and not just the shallow pleasures of a comedy or an action film, which I also do enjoy. Believe me, I watch plenty of TV.
I don't even know if I can make it through this segment, man. You're not. I'll tell you, when Isabel's being pedantic, it's much more entertaining.
When is Isabel ever pedantic?
She's not.
She has that sort of airhead sprite
character
that she does.
This is what I wanted. I wanted to fuel the fire a little bit in the lead up to our the results of our womano imano competition between the two of you. And
I don't know about that. Do me a favor. I don't know if I can compete with a Justin Bieber film recommendation.
Oh, that's what I wanted to hear. I haven't shown that to Miley yet.
Sam,
even Miley was like,
"I
don't like Justin Bieber."
Art is not a competition. It's not a competition.
No, but this isn't art.
Why would you reduce politics to talking heads? Would you want to do that with art?
This is not art. This is a competition not between art. This is a competition between recommenders of art. It's different.
All right, then I want to win.
Right, of course. How would you characterize, just to get a one, how would you characterize the films that Isabel Gilley suggests?
The documentaries that she suggests are sort of, sort of shallowly politically relevant. And she tries to have a theme, which I appreciate, but they're not exactly deep thinkers.
Wow. Man. The king of insults.
I really do not want to do this. I don't want to, because I'm like, if I go after her, I don't want to hurt her. I want to be her friend. I want her to be my friend. And I just think that.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, she doesn't know how to listen to the show. So.
I know. But it makes me,
She hasn't quite figured it out. She's only been doing this show for over a year now. She hasn't quite figured out how to actually listen to it on her computer.
Yeah, well, she's got her anger blog to update or whatever she's got to do.
Wow, that was rather dismissive. She's a best-selling author, Matthew.
I never heard of her book.
Well, maybe you don't read enough, but she's a New York Times best-selling author. So,
oh, well, there's no accounting for...
Excuse me?
I said there's no accounting for taste.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm sure she's great. Sam, you're forcing me
Film
into
guy
this position.
Matthew,
I hate this.
Laying down the gauntlet. All right, so let's hear what you have for us this week, Matthew. What erudite, sophisticated, nuanced film recommendation do you have for us?
Say mise en scène again, Sam.
Mise en scène.
Exactly, very good.
What did I say, mise en scène?
No, you said it fine. I just want to hear you, drop some buzzwords.
Right.
So, listen, this week's film is not necessarily an erudite film, but since it's the Sundance Film Festival this week and neither you nor I are attending in any capacity, I thought I would recommend a film that made a splash at last year's Sundance Film Festival, which is now on
video on demand. Oh, so stealing a page from Isabel and doing like a theme.
Isabel is my inspiration. I do everything like Isabel.
Fair enough. All right, what do you recommend?
So this film is called Compliance. And I don't know if you've heard the story behind it.
No.
It's directed by a guy named Craig Zobel, who I've met once or twice. He's a very nice guy. And his previous film was really good called Great World of Sound. And this one, though, it might remind you of your toilet scrubbing job. I don't know if
Compliance.
It doesn't have Chariots of Fire in it, but it's about an incident that occurred at a fast food restaurant, and it's based on a true incident. It's a kind of a squirm in your seat slash voyeuristic slash maybe a little condescending slash disgusting to the point of fascination kind of a movie.
Well, we anticipate that most of your movie recommendations are going to be implicitly condescending.
No. The film may be somewhat condescending to its characters, not my suggestion.
Okay,
basically, this is about a manager at a fast food restaurant who takes a call from someone claiming to be a police officer with evidence that one of the young female employees has stolen money from a customer.
I just watched this movie on Netflix like the other day.
You did?
Yes.
What do you say?
Okay.
It's an amazing movie.
Wow. Matthew, it's like you and Matt are simpatico.
Well, what can I say? Game recognizes game.
There you go. All right.
Continue talking about it. Continue.
Okay, thank you. So basically what happens is the guy on the phone has this woman embark on a series of ever more degrading searches and punishments of this female employee, which eventually results in a sexual assault. And that's not really a spoiler since it's a news story that's been around for a few years. This actually happened.
I never heard of it.
And so it's based on a true incident, not like Zero Dark Thirty.
True incidents, multiple incidents.
Wow.
Yeah, multiple incidents. Apparently about 70 of these have actually occurred, where someone has been fooled into thinking the person on the phone is the police and forced someone else into these degrading positions.
Oh, so I'm
not totally sure the film works quite perfectly, either as a narrative or a kind of psychological insight into how or why these kinds of things happen, but it does play them out for you in a very controlled, interesting, if slightly sensationalistic manner for you to kind of assimilate and contemplate. And I kind of wish the film hadn't been so hard on some of what you might call the perpetrators, giving them just a slightly too pat emotional motivation. But I can hardly blame him because it's for not being like able to 100% explain why these people do this thing, because it's hard to understand why, when faced with authority figures, certain well-meaning people can both allow and even perpetrate such heinous acts.
It's like the Milgram experiment.
I'm interested in, exactly. It brings up a lot of references to that implicitly, and I'm very interested in hearing what you make of it, because like I said, I found myself kind of rejecting the film, which if I didn't know was based on a real incident, I'd say the characters were totally unbelievable. But that's the kind of fascinating thing about watching the film. While it doesn't have much narrative arc, it plays more like an extended dramatization of this anecdote. It's very compelling with a really, really thick mix of disgust and taboo power trips and train wreck human behavior.
I completely disagree with you. I felt like even if you didn't know it was a true story, the little bit they tell you about those characters leading into the incident is certainly enough to make it completely believable that these are the type of people that would do this.
Hmm.
I want to say I agree, but it's just they felt like a little too shorthandy. Like, oh, they left the freezer open, so she's going to be really susceptible to whatever punishment she's going to be given. I mean, it's a very hard thing to find out why do people do this. And occasionally I thought the film was saying, like, these people are such idiots.
Well,
opposed to they're you and me who would do this in this situation.
The character this happens to is a very – the character this happens to is a very young girl who makes it clear that she really needs this job. So she's doing whatever she can to prove she didn't commit this crime that this fake police officer is accusing her of. So I think it's completely believable that knowing that she's a young girl in this this very small town who needs this job, that she would try to do whatever she could to show that she did not do what she's being accused of doing.
All right. Well,
I can see that, and it plays.
How about I watch the film before we get into
this is why it's fun, because now people are going to be forced to go watch the movie and come back and listen to the show.
There's nobody listening to the show anymore. they've all turned off their iPods.
No, they've not.
Oh my God. All right. Let's get to the nub of this. What should I name my kid? I'll watch Compliant. I'll watch that movie. Okay. I got two movies to watch. Kid with a Bike and Compliant. But what should I name my kid?
Isn't it Compliance?
Okay.
Compliance. Yeah. Compliant.
With a
CE. You got to make sure you get the right movie, Sam.
All right. Let's hear a kid name recommendation. It better not be Matthew, because that's not happening.
Wait, I'll think of another one.
Yeah. Better not be Film Guy either.
First of all, I like Saul.
All right. Thank you.
Because the middle name could be Ty.
Saul Ty?
Yeah.
Saul Ty?
I don't get it.
No,
Saul Ty?
you're not getting that? Saul Ty from Battlestar Galactica, Sam, your favorite show?
Oh, yeah. You know, Edward almost just started following me on Twitter.
Edward's a good name?
He almost started following you on Twitter?
No, he just started following.
Oh, okay.
Edward almost.
No, his name is Edward almost. That's a good one. That's a good one.
Oh, my God.
What about weird. Have you thought of Zach?
Yeah, we've thought of Zach.
Have you thought of Franklin?
Franklin?
I see a turtle whenever I hear.
Yeah,
name Franklin.
I mean, I actually have thought about that.
Okay, what about Passover?
Passover Center.
That would just give him too much more confusion. Too much confusion.
You know who's better
or,
at this?
Or
Isabel.
Who?
Name recommendation.
Sam, you're an instigator. Do you need ratings that badly to make people fight on your show?
Yes.
It's like I feel like I'm on Fox and Friends here.
Right.
Come on.
Yes. Bingo.
What
okay.
about Sue?
All right. All
a boy
right.
named Sue.
I'll try to play along.
Well, give me one more.
Galactica
right.
Cedar.
That's it. Okay.
That was terrible.
Guess what? You're not gonna.
I ran season. Out. I had a couple legit ones, and you didn't like them. So you know what can I tell you.
All right. Well, Matthew, I think your film suggestions are better than your child name suggestions. You still have a couple of weeks, anyways, to work on it.
You could take that because the reverse is true for Isabel Gillies.
It's quite possible.
Well, exactly.
Oh,
thank
Matt.
You. Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Exactly true.
We may not name this kid for months, anyway. So we'll see. But Film Guy Matthew, we will speak to you within several weeks, and we will have this throwdown. I will have watched both those films in that time. Probably not. And I appreciate your giving us film recommendations for the weekend.
Well, thanks for having me, Sam. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, for me.
I know. All right, Matthew. Thanks again.
Take care.
Bye.
You're welcome.